is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
Listen to verse 255 of chapter Baqarah, recited by Mr. Ali Asghar Burumand.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Allahu la ilaha illa huwa القيوم لا تأخذه سنة ولا نوم له ما في السماوات وما من ذا الذي يشفع عنده إلا بإذنه لا تأخذه سنة ولا نوم له ما في السماوات والأرض من ذا الذي يشفع عنده إلا بإذنه يعلم ما بين أيديه ولا يحيطون بشيء من علمه إلا بما شاء وسع كرسيه السماوات والأرض ولا وهو العلي العظيم. صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the most compassionate, the most merciful. Allah is He, besides whom there is no God, the ever-living, the self-subsisting, by whom all subsist. Slumber does not overtake him, nor sleep. Whatever is in the heavens and whatever is in the earth is his. Who is he that can intercede with him but by his permission? He knows what is before them and what is behind them, and they cannot comprehend anything out of his knowledge except what he pleases. His knowledge extends over the heavens and the earth, and the preservation of them both tires him not, and he is the Most High, the Great.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Headlines: at least 19 people are killed, many more wounded in a suicide bombing on an educational center in Afghanistan. Hamas condemns Israel's crimes against Palestinian children and civilians as a reflection of the regime's, quote, sadistic policy. At least 19 people have died in Florida in the aftermath of Hurricane Ian as it leaves a trail of destruction across the U.S. state. Hello and welcome. Thank you for joining us. My name is Gisoum Shahmadi, and these are our top stories at this hour. A deadly suicide attack at an education center in Afghanistan has left at least 19 people dead. The blast happened in Dasht-e-Bachi neighborhood, western Kabul. It took place as the students were preparing for an exam. Police say the attack has left over two dozen injured. No group has so far claimed responsibility. Afghanistan's Interior Ministry has slammed the attack, saying those who target civilians prove their inhumane cruelty and lack of moral standards. Our correspondent in Kabul, Rahmatullah Bakhman, joined us earlier with more details on the attack.
A local source who was also the eyewitness of the explosion told me that the suicide attacker first approached the gate of the educational center and shot the security guards. Then he entered the classroom that was a classroom of girls and opened fire on the girls, then detonated his explosives and blew up the classroom. Most of the casualties are girls. People here in Kabul are rushing to the hospitals to donate blood for the victims or for the injured people that are received by the hospitals. Only Muhammad Ali Jinnah Hospital in the neighborhood has received 10 dead and more than 15 injured. Other victims are taken to other hospitals. Local sources said that the figure or the number of casualties are higher than what is announced by the Kabul police spokesman, and that is rightly surprised because most people or the injured people are in very critical conditions.
The Palestinian resistance movement Hamas says Israel's crimes against Palestinian children reflect the regime's sadistic policies against civilians. Hamas emphasized that Israel's crimes against Palestinian children, people, land, and sanctities will not make the regime secure, but only strengthen the resistance. It also called on international rights organizations to take serious action to blacklist Israeli leaders over the killing of children. The movement was reacting to the death of seven-year-old Ryan Soleiman, who died of a heart attack after being chased by Israeli forces. The United States has called for a thorough and immediate investigation into the circumstances surrounding the death of the child. In order to discuss that further, we're joined by Moti Abu Mousabi, Palestinian political activist who is joining us from Gaza. Thank you very much for joining us, sir. If you could please tell us more about this situation. Is this an individual incident, something that has not occurred before, or there have been similar instances which were maybe not covered by media? And how often do these Israeli forces chase school children, children as young as 6, 7, 8 years old?
Yes, first of all, thanks for having me. In fact, this crime is not the first crime Israel occupation forces commit against the Palestinian people and the Palestinian children specifically, and it would never be the last one. As you know, since the beginning of this year, 2022, more or around 40 Palestinian children have been killed at the hands of the Israeli occupation forces across all Palestinian territories. This crime actually comes in the context and amid ongoing Israeli raids and attacks against the Palestinian cities in the West Bank, Jenin, and Nablus specifically, during which four Palestinian youth were assassinated by the Israeli forces. And I think this is considered as an ongoing Israeli terrorism practice against the Palestinian people amid flagrant silence of the international community and the whole world towards those crimes. Actually, Israel tries by leaps and bounds to create a new de facto on the ground, to impose a new situation on the ground with this regard. This escalation we are witnessing across all Palestinian territories comes as a response to the ongoing Israeli crimes, especially when it comes to Al-Aqsa Mosque, as Israel tries to change the spatial and temporal realities on the ground there.
Mr. Abu Mousabi, you know, one would think that you talked about Israeli forces killing Palestinian children. In this particular case, the child was not directly killed by the Israeli forces, but let's imagine how terrified that child had been in order to have a heart attack from being chased by Israeli forces, and the amount of attention and pressure that the child has felt at that moment. And this is something I would like you to discuss some more. And also, why does even Israel go after school children? I mean, these are young children. What can they do? How dangerous can they be? They are 6, 7, 8 year old school children, for God's sake.
As you have mentioned, that this is kind of the ongoing Israeli attitude when it comes to practice the terrorism against the Palestinian people and terrorize the Palestinian generations in order to deter those generations that the Israeli occupation has a powerful response towards any kind whoever thinks even to resist the Israeli occupation. It's not about facing or responding to any kind of imminent threat. As you have mentioned, what is that kind of imminent threat that could be posed by 7-year-old children, Palestinian children, towards the well-armed Israeli soldiers who are armed with all kind of weapons and with tools. So we are in front of a clear terrorism and brutality practiced by the Israeli occupation. It's not about responding or just reacting to any kind of actions or acts practiced by the Palestinian people. I think this crime is flagrant enough to put the international community and the international human rights organizations in front of their responsibilities, to stand up for the responsibilities and to defend Palestinians' rights, and to understand how this kind of dark side of suffering of the Palestinian people that could be untold or unseen by many people worldwide. Today, this crime should put that international community and the U.S. administration in front of their ethical and human responsibility, because Israel, the U.S. administration claims defending human rights and defending, and they are saying that they are obliged to bring those who are responsible for human rights violations and war crimes to international criminal court. So what about the Israeli occupation leaders who are committing crimes, war crimes against the Palestinian people and the Palestinian children left, right, and center on a daily basis? So this reveals how unjust and how biased the U.S. administration and the international community is.
So Mr. Abu Musaib, do you believe that this can be followed up in the ICC?
No, as long as the international community and the U.S. attitude towards this Palestinian issue as it is now, I think nothing will be changed. Today, what we are waiting for and what we need as Palestinians, actually, as Palestinians, is to change the way they are dealing with the Zionist occupation and the Israeli occupation. They are giving literally the Israeli occupation the full impunity and the full protection, which gives the Israeli occupation the green light to commit more and more crimes. Unless the Israeli occupation feels for a while that it would pay the price of any crime committed against the Palestinian people, it will never change its policy towards the Palestinian people.
Thank you very much, Mr. Moti Abu Musabe, Palestinian political activist from Gaza. Our correspondent in Ramallah, Mona Kendall, says Israeli soldiers attacked the village to arrest Palestinians, and they were even seeking to arrest school children.
Of course, it's a very sad and heartbreaking. 7-year-old Palestinian, a child, Rayan Suleiman, from the village of Taqwa, was returning back home from his school, and Israeli soldiers had already raided the village of Taqwa, claiming that they want to arrest Palestinians and even students, school students, whom the Israeli soldiers accused them for throwing stones at Israeli military vehicles. According to the father of Rayan Suleiman, the Israeli soldiers were chasing the children returning back from school, and then some soldiers had already raided the house while they carry out searches and inspections. They raided the house of little Suleiman, and they were a little bit, let's say, investigating his father or something like that. Israeli military claim that they didn't even raid Taqwa at that time. Other stories are saying that it's true. Israeli troops raided Taqwa, but one of the Israeli officers were speaking calmly to the father of little Suleiman, and they were not chasing any Palestinian children.
South Korean President Yoon Suk-yeol calls for urgent measures to contain fluctuations in domestic markets as the country's national currency has fallen to a 13-year low. At a meeting of the top economic officials, Yoon said that it is time to contend with market volatility and find a way for more stability. South Korea's won has lost 17% of its value against the U.S. dollar this year. The benchmark KOSPI shared an index also slumped 27% in the same period. Economists in the country have warned of a capital flight and urged the government to intervene in the market. Our correspondent Frank Smith says the South Korean president is facing pressure to stabilize financial markets as his approval ratings have decreased to its lowest level since he took office.
Well, as you mentioned, just to review some of the numbers, the won dollar right now is at 1,450 South Korean won to a dollar. That's a 14-year low, 17% down on year. But we're also seeing a strong dollar, or extremely strong dollar against the British pound and euro. So President Yoon and some analysts are putting this really on foreign factors that are having an impact here. The president is also under pressure to do something about this because of his lagging approval rating. He's down at 24% following a hot mic incident in the U.S. where he was caught allegedly using foul language to refer to the U.S. Congress, and that also got his foreign minister in trouble with a motion of no confidence on his foreign minister. We are seeing some extraordinary volatility here in the KOSPI, that's the South Korean stock market, that's lost 27% of its value, as you mentioned, this year, and that has to do with foreigners also exiting the market in large numbers, with foreign investment in the KOSPI declining by $8 billion this year. And that's also, all of this is also related, say experts, to the U.S. raising its interest rate and also increased fears of a recession.
U.S. President Joe Biden refrained from declassifying an intelligence report on the murder of Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi, despite a government panel advising him to do so. Now, that is according to a report by the Wall Street Journal. It says a panel of experts was formed in 2020 to review documents on Khashoggi's murder. In June, they recommended declassifying the file in its entirety, only weeks before Biden's visit to Saudi Arabia. However, the president refused to do so. Advocates have criticized Biden's move. Saudi journalist Khashoggi was murdered and dismembered at the kingdom's consulate in Turkey in 2018. U.S. intelligence has confirmed that Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman was the one to order his killing. Hurricane Ian in the U.S. has become powerful again in the Atlantic after it showed little signs of weakening. Ian has intensified into a Category 1 storm. It has generated winds surpassing the speed of 135 kilometers per hour. The hurricane is now churning through the South Carolina coast after pummeling Florida, but the devastation still remains in the southern U.S. state, where island residents don't have access to the mainland. Rescue operations are underway to help the stranded people. According to U.S. media reports, at least 19 people have been killed. Millions of residents across vast parts of Florida are also grappling with power outages. Ian is said to be one of the most devastating hurricanes in U.S. history. The United States midterm elections are now less than 6 weeks away, with Republicans expected to retake control of the House. The Russian president has signed decrees recognizing the two southern Ukrainian regions of Kherson and Zaporizhzhia as independent territories. This came before Vladimir Putin is to formally sign documents on Friday proclaiming Russia's annexation of the two regions, as well as Donetsk and Lugansk regions. People in the four regions have already voted to join Russia in separate referendums. With these regions annexed, 15% of Ukraine's territory will become part of Russia. Anchored by Putin's move, UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres described it as, quote, a dangerous escalation. Antonio Guterres added that the move would further jeopardize the prospects for peace and has no legal value. In reaction, Russia's UN mission accused the UN chief of violating the UN Charter with his remarks. The mission said Guterres does not have the right to make political statements on behalf of the United Nations as a whole. That brings us to the end of this edition of World News. Stay tuned.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Supplication on Fridays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, the first before the bringing forth and the giving of life, and the last after the annihilation of all things. The All-Knowing who forgets not him who remembers him, and decreases not him who thanks him, and disappoints not him who supplicates him, and cuts not off the hope of him who hopes in him. O Allah, I call thee to witness, and thou art sufficient witness. And I call to witness all thy angels, and the inhabitants of thy heavens, and the bearers of thy throne, and thy prophets, and thy messengers, whom thou hast sent out, and the various kinds of creatures thou hast brought forth, that I bear witness that thou art Allah. There is no God but thou, thou alone, who hast no associate nor any equal, and thy word has no failing nor any change. And that Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, is thy servant and thy messenger. He delivered to the servants that with which thou charged him, and he struggled for Allah as is his due. And he gave the good news of the truth of reward, and he warned of the veracity of punishment. O Allah, make me firm in thy religion as long as thou keepst me alive. And make not my heart to swerve after thou hast guided me, and give me mercy from thee. Surely thou art the giver. Bless Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, and make me one of his followers and his partisans. And muster me in his band, and give me the success of accomplishing the obligatory observance of Friday, and performing the acts of obedience which thou hast made incumbent upon me within it, and receiving the bestowal which thou hast apportioned for its people on the day of recompense. Thou, only thou, art the mighty ones.
In the limelight.
From declining monarch butterflies in North America to disappearing bumblebees in Europe, there is mounting evidence that insects are in rapid decline. Please stay with us for an article in this regard written by Dave Galson, writer. This article is published under the heading Climate Crisis is Killing Off Key Insects and Spreading Insect-Borne Diseases. Here's more.
Love them or loathe them, we need insects, yet their numbers are decreasing. From declining monarch butterflies in North America to disappearing bumblebees in Europe, there is mounting evidence that insects are in rapid decline. This should worry us all, for insects are overwhelmingly important. They are food for innumerable larger creatures such as birds and bats. They control pests, recycle nutrients, help to keep the soil healthy, and they pollinate 3/4 of the crops we grow. Without insects, life as we know it would grind to a halt. The causes of insect declines are numerous, with habitat loss and the industrialization of global farming leading the way, assisted by growing use of pesticides, the depredations of invasive species, increasing light pollution, and more. Populations of many insects are now much reduced compared to the past, and most now exist in habitat islands, fragments of their favored habitat surrounded by inhospitable terrain. Sadly, climate change is likely to be the final straw for some. Of course, the climate has changed in the past many times, and insects have survived. Indeed, insects have come through all 5 of the previous mass extinction events on our planet, though many individual species must have been lost. However, this time is different. In the past, climate change was usually much more gradual, and species could gradually shift their ranges in response, shifting towards the poles as the climate warmed and returning towards the equator as it cooled. Such movement used to be easy, for there were vast tracts of suitable habitat. Today, to move polewards, insects must somehow hop from one patch of habitat to the next, crossing roads, landscapes filled with polluting factories, arable fields sprayed with insecticides, housing estates, and other alien human-made landscapes. Insects do not live in isolation, but depend upon particular plants to provide food for their larvae, or nectar and pollen for adults. If these plants haven't traveled ahead of them, for example, via seeds blown on the wild, then they cannot survive. So, entire communities of organisms need to make this journey. It seems that they are failing to do so. Studies of bumblebees in North America and Europe have revealed that they are disappearing from the southern edges of their ranges as the climate becomes too warm for them. But the northern edges of their ranges have not moved northward, as we might expect. It has been described as a climate vice, the ranges of the bees being gradually squashed from the south. Some mountain-dwelling bumblebees in Colorado and Spain have responded to climate warming by moving higher in the mountains, but eventually they will run out of mountain and be left with nowhere else to go. Studies of these mountain bees have also revealed that climate change may disrupt the seasons in subtle but important ways. Many insects time their life cycle carefully to ensure that times of activity coincide with availability of a vital resource. As the climate warms, different organisms may use different cues to time their life cycle, leading to mismatches. For example, some mountain plants in Colorado are now coming into flower before the bumblebees that feed on them have emerged from hibernation, meaning that the plants are not pollinated and set few seed. Bumblebees seem to be particularly sensitive to warming as they are creatures found primarily in cool, temperate climates. Their large size and fairy coats are adaptations to keeping warm in cool conditions, and they literally overheat in hot weather. Above all the 30 degrees Celsius, most bumblebees species seem unable to maintain prolonged activity. The recent heat waves that afflicted much of Europe's temperatures, even in the UK, exceeded 40 degrees Celsius, leaving bumblebees unable to gather food for extended periods. Are bumblebees an exception? Many other insects are more thermophilic, warmth-loving, and thrive in hot climates. For example, many butterflies are at the northern edge of their range in the UK, so we might expect them to benefit from a warmer climate. To test this, the Charity Butterfly Conservation analyzed changes in the populations of 46 butterfly species that all reached the northern edge of their range in the UK, the species we would expect to be enjoying warming. Between 1970 and 2000, three-quarters of these species declined significantly. The pattern differs between sedentary habitat specialists, fussy species with very specific requirements and low mobility, comprising 28 species, and the generalist, highly mobile species, 18 species. Of the habitat specialist, 89% had declined, while only half of the generalist had declined, and a few, including pest species, were thriving. This gives us a clue as to why climate warming has so far not benefited even warmth-loving butterflies. Mobile generalists can more easily move in response to warming and are more likely to find somewhere where they can survive when they get there. Of course, climate change is not simply a matter of slight increases in temperatures. Perhaps more impactful on wildlife is the increased frequency of extreme weather events such as droughts, heat waves, wildfires, storms, and floods, all of which are likely to become more frequent and more extreme in the future. We have little idea what impact these will have on insects, but of course, very few of them will be positive. Fires will obviously kill insects, although the flush of new flowers that follows fires in some ecosystems would benefit some. Summer storms are likely to batter delicate adult insects such as butterflies, and flash floods are likely to destroy underground nests of creatures such as bumblebees. Drought causes water stress plants to cease nectar production in their flowers, which will certainly harm pollinators. In prolonged droughts, plants wilt and become unpalatable for caterpillars. For example, in the hot British summer of 1967, many caterpillars of the Adonis blue butterfly died as their food plant, horseshoe wedge, shriveled in the heat. As a result, numbers of the adults were much lower in the following year, and some populations died out. With the UK now experiencing the worst drought since 1967, it is a fair bet that 2023 will be an especially poor year for butterflies. Although climate change is undoubtedly bad news for many insects, there is no doubt that some are thriving. Ironically, these tend to be undesirables from a human perspective. Adaptable mobile species that can thrive in urban landscapes, such as houseflies and mosquitoes, are on the increase. For example, the yellow fever mosquito seems to have adapted well to urbanization and thrives in cities, breeding in blocked gutters, discarded tires, barrels, buckets, and any other human refuse that traps puddles of water. It is one of the main vectors of several nasty diseases, including dengue fever, Zika fever, and of course yellow fever, as its name suggests. The Anopheles mosquito, the main transmitter of malaria, is also benefiting from the spread of human activities. Cases of malaria tend to become more frequent in areas where forests are cleared for agriculture because the mosquito likes to breed in sunlit puddles and ditches, which are hard for it to find in dense forests. Climate predictions suggest that malaria is likely to spread to higher altitude regions of the tropics, for example, in Colombia, Kenya, and Ethiopia. These regions are densely populated with humans in part because, until recently, they were largely free from malaria. The southern states of the U.S., southeastern Europe, parts of China, and the densely populated areas surrounding the Sao Paulo and Rio de Janeiro in Brazil are also likely to become suitable for malaria by 2050. Dengue fever is similarly predicted to become far more common throughout North America, as for North and Southern Canada. Clearly, we need to place tackling climate change as the single most urgent priority for humankind, both for the sake of the astonishing biodiversity on our planet and for our own well-being. Preserving as much nature-rich habitat as possible and attempting to link habitat patches together may help insects and other wildlife to cope in the meantime.
IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Midstream.
Loose titles, ill-defined narration, and accusations lacking evidence. This is, in one sentence, the summary of the new but old Western media frenzy against the Islamic Republic of Iran in an attempt to push yet again for the same regime change tactics. Get this. Many pro-color revolution Western websites published this part of the news narrative. Mahsa Amini died after falling into a coma following her arrest by the morality police in Tehran because of her inappropriate dress. But hold on a second. Did the Iranian young woman die the moment the police arrested her? Or was she in shock after being arrested by the police for a felony she had committed according to Iranian law, but having been suffering from chronic disease her entire life, which led to her tragically passing away? The news did not mention that Amini was subjected to any torture. How did she pass away then? A day after Amini's death, Iranian police released a video captured by a CCTV camera documenting the young woman's last moments inside the police station. The footage proves that Mahsa Amini, 22, was not subjected to any violence or physical abuse. The clip shows the Iranian young woman inside the morality police station as she was standing next to a bench, talking to another woman, then suddenly grabbing her head, crashing into a bench, and falling to the ground. At the end of the video, she was taken on a stretcher to the ambulance and from there to the hospital. Iranian police said that Amini suddenly suffered from heart failure in the presence of other people and was immediately taken to the hospital in an emergency situation for treatment, but she sadly did not make it. In addition to the rumors and conflicting narratives that spread after this politically appetizing issue, as some activists called it, a series of global condemnations and denunciations began. The White House said Amini's death was a flagrant and appalling violation of human rights, and the United Nations expressed their usual concern. The European Union considered that what happened to the Iranian girl was unacceptable, while France considered Amini's death shocking. Within hours, news websites and social media platforms were filled with articles, blogs, and TV episodes discussing Mahsa Amini's death, as well as video analysis explaining how she died, directing public opinion against Iran, pushing direct incitement, clear mobilization, and discussion of public and individual freedoms in Tehran. Mind you, the United States of America incarcerates far more of its population per capita than any other country in the world. The UK incarcerates journalist and WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange and prepares to extradite him to the US straight to the hands of the CIA. And the French Senate passed an amendment last year that bans girls under 18 from wearing the hijab in public, prevents mothers from wearing hijabs on their children's school trips, and bans the burkini, a full-body swimsuit. But hold your horses. The UN is worried about women's rights in the Islamic Republic of Iran. Welcome to the Mideast Stream. I'm Marwa Osman. The tragic death of the Iranian young woman Mahsa Amini turned into a fake news bomb that perfectly fits for the bright headlines of the Western mainstream media. A quick scroll through Google search engine, it becomes clear how the media dealt with the death of the Iranian young woman. Loose titles, ill-defined narration, and accusations lacking evidence. In addition to the rumors and conflicting narratives that spread after this politically appetizing issue, typically a series of global condemnations and denunciations began, starting with the blatant hypocrisy of Washington to always so concerned UN, who happens to have never showed any concern for the millions of Iranians suffering from Washington's illegal unilateral punitive measures. To discuss this issue with us from Washington is Jesse Zurwell, writer, editor, researcher, and producer and host at TNT Radio. Thank you for being with us, Jesse. Now, rioters during the recent wave of violence on the streets of several Iranian provinces not only disrupted public security and trashed their own cities, they went as far as terrorism, cutting and slitting the throats of security officers, of Iranian police officers who tried to retain safety and security to the streets of their country. How far do you think this very suspicious wave of violence is going to go in Iran?
It's hard to say how far it will go, but I think it will go as far as those who are responsible for this chaos want it to go. unless and until the authorities in Iran put a stop to it, which they've been trying to do since the very beginning. And as you said, they've met with outright violence from vandalism and fires and actual rioting to the cutting of throats of police officers or law enforcement, which is not something that one would typically associate with Iranians who care about their country, who care about the rule of law. What is happening has all the hallmarks of a color revolution in service of regime change. And though we don't know for sure who is behind this, we can make some very good guesses as to who is responsible. And as we know from past experiences, they will stop at nothing unless they are stopped or they achieve their aims. I don't think they will achieve their aims, as has been the case in the past. But again, they will take this as far as they feel necessary to take it, unless and until they are stopped by Iranian authorities.
Well, Jesse, it's not new nor surprising to actually see how Western mainstream media is taking advantage of the recent situation in Iran, claiming all sorts of humanitarian violations while they persecute their own people at home against free speech, to say the least, and while they take part in normalizing the West's brutal unilateral punitive measures against Iran and against other countries as well. And they do that without even flinching. They don't care. But what I want to know is, are there any real ripples inside the U.S. Society, at the public level, I mean, concerning this new wave of attack against Iran? Are the public really believing what their regime is trying to portray of the Iranian state?
I'm sad to say that at the public level here in the U.S., it's barely making an impact, if any impact at all. Most people are not aware of what's happening in Iran right now. And if they are, they're not paying attention very closely to it outside of what's being spewed by the likes of the corporate media, likes of CNN and Fox News, which has been ad nauseum to suggest, to declare that the Iranian state is carrying out violence against its citizens, that the Iranian state murdered the young woman in question when there's clear evidence that that is not what happened. The situation in Europe as opposed to the U.S. there seems to be a bit more awareness. There seems to be more propaganda in public and a public that is willing to fall for the propaganda. But here in the U.S., it comes primarily through corporate media, and people, if they care at all, pay attention just to what is told to them by corporate media and do no more research than that.
How do people like you, Jesse, get to know what is going on, and where do you get your news from?
Well, speaking for myself, I go to Iranian sources, I go to Press TV, of course, and I go to various independent media sources that actually are paying attention to what's happening in Iran and paying attention to it in a way that is not just regurgitating state propaganda. That said, it's still difficult to get an exact picture as to what's going on, but if you pay attention to corporate media, you're getting a very distorted, I would say completely inaccurate picture of what's going on.
What we saw and we are still seeing in Iran at maybe a lower pace than what happened during the past few days is a page from the Color Revolution Manual 101 that we have seen for the past at least 15 years, from riots to violence against security personnel to killing civilians and claiming that the authorities actually did it. This is exactly what we saw in Daraa in Syria in 2011, and before that in Ukraine and in Georgia. But with all that is going on right now with the world, and we are literally two steps behind World War III. What good does the U.S. really think it can get from instigating such an unrest, knowing that Iran is honestly not Syria?
I don't know Iran, the U.S. is certainly playing with fire with regard to Iran. It's not in an economic position to be waging such warfare, really, against Iran, economic warfare and regime change warfare. And perhaps this is at the behest of Israel. We certainly need to ask that question, and we need to ask to what extent the EU and UK are involved in this. It's very, very suspicious that this comes right after Iran was formally welcomed into the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, and it comes at a time when the president of Iran is speaking before the UN General Assembly. Certainly, Iran is making moves on the world stage to try to benefit itself. And since the revolution in 1979, the U.S. and the broader West has stood completely against any sort of self-determination on the part of Iran. So it seems to me that what the U.S. is trying to do here is what it's always been trying to do, though it's certainly upped the game. It's using more intense tactics than it has in the past, but it seems unlikely to succeed because Iran knows how to deal with this sort of chaos, this provocation, but time will tell. Time will
definitely
certainly tell.
They have been through this before, but they were able to bypass all of the attempts by the U.S. to wreak havoc and disturb the security in Tehran and elsewhere, in other provinces as well in Iran. Thank you very much, Jesse Zurwal, writer, editor, researcher, and producer and host at TNT Radio, for being with us and for your contribution. Now, please stay tuned, because next we will talk about something that the mainstream media did not mention. They ignored the U.S. occupation's killing of a young Iraqi teenager.
This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marwa Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts. Midstream is with you every Friday on IRIB English Radio.
Now, in Iraq, a teenage girl named Zainab Isam Al-Khazali was killed because of a stray bullet from an American occupation base situated inside Baghdad's international airport. It's not enough that the Americans are illegally residing as a form of occupation inside the international airport of a supposedly sovereign state, yet they blatantly use live ammo while fully aware that the airport is encircled by civilian residential neighborhoods, leading to the murder of a young Iraqi teenager named Zainab Al-Khazali. Iraqis are infuriated by the crime. They demanded their authorities to investigate the cowardly incident that affected all families in the village of Abu Alwan in the Abu Ghraib area amid a total media blackout. U.S. occupation kills Iraqi teenager in this following report.
The killing of the 15-year-old girl Zainab Isam Al-Khazali in the Abu Ghraib area, west of the capital Baghdad, by an alleged stray bullet sparked a wave of anger on social media platforms in Iraq. Politicians and activists accused U.S. occupation forces of killing the girl while training in a nearby camp. The bullet ended the life of the young woman, Zainab, as a result of a gunshot wound that came from a military shooting range near the village of Bu Alwan in Abu Ghraib district. For its part, the Baghdad Operations Command decided to open an investigation into the death of the teenage girl. The Iraqi security media cell said in a statement that the competent authorities supervising the course of investigation will announce to public opinion its reasons and will take the necessary legal measures against anyone who is proven to be involved in this incident. Iraqi politicians and bloggers accused the U.S. occupation forces of killing Zainab, and one of the most prominent tweets on that matter was attributed to the Secretary General of Asaib Ahlul Haq, Qais Al-Khazali, who demanded an immediate investigation into the killing of the girl. the hashtag America Killed Zainab became trending, and this came based on the testimony of the people of the region in a video clip circulating on social media platforms that the bullet came from a training camp inside Baghdad International Airport, in reference to the American Victoria occupation base located inside the airport. The martyrdom of the Iraqi girl Zainab, shot by the American occupation forces in Baghdad, does not seem to be passing unnoticed inside Iraq. The public are demanding government agencies investigate the cowardly, treacherous incident that affected Iraqi families in the village of Al Bualwan in the Abu Ghraib area. Meanwhile, Iraqis were not the slightest surprised that the Western mainstream media remained silent about this crime while it is dancing nonstop to the tune of regime change in Iran. Western and regional media hypocrisy does not surprise any of the natives of West Asia, those who are with one-eyed humanity. How many times have we seen them rising up for shenanigans under the pretext of human rights and keeping silent about the massacres of the occupation, be it the American or the Zionist occupation? The silence of the media, activists and politicians who were tweeting round the clock attempting to incite civil war in Iraq not so long ago are nothing less than partners in crime to the repetitive crimes of the American occupation, not only in Iraq, but across all the world.
To discuss this tragedy with us from Beirut is Julia Qasim, journalist and political commentator. Thank you very much for being with us, Julia. Now, if you want to know how Zainab died, by browsing the news, we will often read this specific piece of information. It says, a stray bullet ended the life of young Zainab as a result of a gunshot wound coming from a military shooting range near the village of Al Bualwan. A gunshot wound originating from a military shooting range. This is what it said. This means that the killer is known or the suspect is well defined, but the news is incomplete and is not clear from an editorial point of view, at least, to say. Military shooting range belonging to whom? Does a stray bullet, Julia, take responsibility instead of a shooter?
You answered the question yourself, Marwa. The military range shooting was, the language for that is intentionally obscured because it is a site of the U.S. occupation, which is illegally in Iraq, which is illegally established its presence in Iraq decades ago and refuses to leave despite the will of the Iraqis. So while the media can obfuscate the accountability and the responsibility by trying to claim that a stray bullet did not intentionally kill Zainab Aysam, it still is indicative when the mask of the language is uncovered that this was a that the U.S. occupation is accountable for this action, just as it is accountable for the deaths of millions in Iraq. The language of collateral damage that was employed by the imperialist leadership that justified the war crimes that took place in Iraq also could have been obfuscated to signify that, oh, the deaths of millions of Iraqis and of countless civilians, children, women, did constitute a non-intentional attack. But nonetheless, it was the direct result of an illegal occupation that involved brutal force against a civilian population. And this is no different.
Well, so a 15-year-old Iraqi teenager, her name is Zainab Aysam Al-Khazali. She was killed by a stray bullet in her own father's field. Yet people might not have even heard of her name before now, before even watching this show right now, or the events that actually led to her murder, because international media, they did not only black out on the story, they were busy broadcasting regime change propaganda against the Islamic Republic of Iran. How do you assess the hypocrisy of the media, especially in a case like this one, a clear-cut case?
Right, and it's absolutely necessary that Zainab Aysam's name in her case is obscured so that while the media is propagating the narrative of the evil Iranian regime that is just brutalizing women and is directly responsible for the death of Miss Amini, which anybody has access to the footage. It was widely broadcasted. It's available. It clearly shows that there was no evidence of beating, but that narrative had to take precedent in order to justify the imperialist feminist push to again demonize Iran and launch this narrative as in attempts to launch another soft war, color revolution campaign. And to have this occur simultaneously with the death of Zainab Issam, it's not possible because people had to, the consent for imperialism had to be manufactured. So to have these stories heard and broadcasted simultaneously would present a contradiction in the imperialist narrative that would also, that would hold the U.S. accountable for it's for the death of Zainab Khalil, but at the same time wants to hone in on focusing on holding, manufacturing a narrative around the Iranian government of its supposed legitimacy and its brutality, particularly against women, which is a very, very common and recurring trope in U.S. propaganda and Western propaganda against Iran. And again, in one case, it was very obvious who were the culprits of the killing of Zainab Issam were. But in the second case, the putting the Iranian government to blame and the Iranian officer and manufacturing this narrative of brutality was construed. It was obviously a narrative pushed without an absence of evidence. Mm-hmm. Now, whether it was the case that she died in police custody or was affected by the stress due to her
chronic disease, she had chronic disease before.
Right. Right.
So that's basically the fingers of accusations are directed in Iraq against the occupation forces, the American occupation forces, unlike what they are propagating about Ms. Mahsa Amini in Tehran. But they did not provide a justification or an explanation for what they did to